This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Co.us. Voters who have returned their ballots can check their ballot status at www.oregonvotes.org. The main issues on the special election ballot are the question of whether Portland should fluoridate its water, a renewal of the children's levy, and a selection of school board members. KBOO Sequoia Wright spoke with voters at the Multnomah County Elections ballot box area today to ask who voted for or against the fluoridation on the voter ballot.
My name's April, and I voted no against fluoride because I'm a born-raised Oregonian. I'm 46 and have no cavities.
So why did you vote against it? I mean, what is it about fluoride that you don't, why you wouldn't want it in the water?
Chemicals in the water, fish, and just, you know, just in general, more chemicals in our system.
I voted on the tax measures because I wasn't familiar with the candidates for the offices, and I voted for both the levies, but not for fluoridation.
So you didn't vote for fluoride in the water?
I voted against that.
We voted because it's our civic duty.
Okay, and did you vote for fluoride or did you vote against it?
We canceled each other out.
I voted against it.
You did vote against it?
And I voted for it.
You did?
But yeah. I was ambivalent.
Why did you vote for it?
I was ambivalent, so I don't know. There's both sides are so strong that I was so torn. I could talk myself in and out of it all day long, and so since he voted against it, I voted for it. I just figured then it wouldn't really count.
I just didn't want to add fluoride in it because we travel around the world, and Portland has a great water, and I don't want to add anything to
it. Any other states or countries that you've been to, do they have fluoride, and do you hear any thing against why they didn't want fluoride?
We just traveled to 13 countries in the last 7 months, and we couldn't find good water. We had to purchase bottled water in most of those countries. So,
right.
So the issue is they don't treat their water at all.
Right.
And then so fluoride or no fluoride, it's got, like, you know, E. coli in it. So it's whatever.
I voted for this election in favor of no fluoridation to our water and for the levy for the kids. I'm all about no chemicals in our water. I don't think it's fair to put any sort of chemicals in any water for anybody.
Okay. All right. Well, did you vote for or against fluoride?
I voted for it.
You did what?
Because there's no scientific evidence that the amounts that they're talking about putting in Portland's water supply are harmful. All of the evidence has been funded mostly by out-of-state interests and using questionable, at best, science, or they'll leave pieces of crucial information out.
Did you vote for the fluoride in the water?
I did not.
You
did not.
Why?
No. Because I think it boils down to water is a human right. Fresh water is a human right. Everybody, you know, is entitled to that, and we need to keep fluoridation chemicals out of that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, people deserve fresh water. It is a human right. Yeah, and I want to keep it as pure as possible. Portland has some of the best drinking water in the United States. Well, I actually grew up in Vancouver, Washington, across the river, and I like Portland water. I mean, I grew up there. Yeah, and so did my wife as well. And, you know, we've both had our fair share of teeth problems. You know, it's not like fluoride in the water up there really significantly helped. And I just think it's fairly anecdotal for people to say, oh, I moved to Portland and I got a cavity here and it must be the fluoride, you know, now I'm fluoridated water. But I mean, the reality is there's a lot much more to working class issues, to people of color issues, than just fluoride in the water. It's about poverty, and fluoride is not going to fix that.
A few of the voters who were turning in their ballot did not realize that voters that live in Gresham and East County were not allowed to vote on the fluoride issue.
My name's Jeremy. I voted this election because I vote in every election. I voted for fluoride. I think that's the big one. It seems to me that it makes sense and that all the anti-stuff is kind of overblown. So yeah, I think it's important, especially for lower-income people, to have access to fluoride. And
so, why do you think it's that lower-income people should have fluoride as opposed to people who are not lower income, you know? I mean, what's your reasoning behind that?
It's good for both, but lower income people have less access to dental care, often don't have insurance or insurance that covers dental care. And so they're going to be the most likely affected by, you know, cavities and that kind of stuff, which can impound and cause infections. And
now, did you know that, okay, so a lot of, there are a lot of lower income people were pushed out to Gresham and then, you know, in the Rockwood area and things like that. Did you know that they didn't get to vote this election on that?
No, I didn't.
That wasn't on there. That wasn't on our ballot.
Wow. Does this affect them, though?
What do you mean?
Like, if we have fluoride in our water, will the people out in Gresham...
Because it's still part of Bull Run.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we did not get to vote on that. Does that make a difference?
I think that's kind of messed up, voicing this just as much as anybody in Portland does.
Okay. Well, Jeremy, thank you very much for giving your take on it.
Yes.
And we appreciate you voting.
Uh-huh. My name's Tracy. Why I vote? Because I guess it's a democratic freedom we have, and I should exercise that as an American citizen. And what did I vote for? Mainly the fluoride issue and for the children's levy.
Okay.
Those were kind of two big ones.
And so how did you vote for fluoride?
Do I have to say it? Isn't that, it's a secret ballot? I voted for the greater public health. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, my name is Lori, and I believe that we're protecting everyone. We want safe water here in Portland. There are many, many people who will be adversely affected. Mm-hmm. There are many people who can't afford it, and there are much better ways to help those with dental problems. Get them access,
right.
But don't poison the rest of us. So vote no, and then let's come together as a community and help those who need dental access. Let's do that. Go KBOO! Thank you for, you guys covered this the most fair of everyone here, so we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Those were sound bites taken by KBOO's Sequoia Wright at the Multnomah County elections this afternoon.
Yesterday, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales negotiated a revised budget with the Fire Bureau to allow all fire stations to maintain four-person crews. Originally, the mayor called for two-person teams in order to reduce the number of fire trucks needed to respond to emergencies. The two-person rapid response vehicles are essentially SUVs that are equipped with basic medical equipment. But emergency personnel complained about Mayor Hale's proposal, saying that in many emergency situations, a two-person crew is not sufficient. The mayor made his proposal as part of a plan to cut $21 million from the city budget this year. The new plan will not force fire stations to replace fire trucks with the emergency response SUVs, but will add these vehicles to four fire stations. This will allow those stations the flexibility to respond to emergency with smaller vehicles than fire trucks, if at all possible, but the Fire Bureau will still need to cut 4% from its budget. To do that, equipment will be replaced at two stations and staff reduced. The station still facing cuts are the station on Northeast 122nd Avenue and the one on North Lombard and Interstate.
A judge fined TriMet $5,000 for failing to release internal documents in a civil rights lawsuit on behalf of pedestrians killed in a bus accident. The TriMet driver had been found guilty of six traffic violations, including making an illegal left turn after the bus ran into five pedestrians in Portland's Old Town on April 24, 2010. Federal Judge Michael Mosman determined that the legal team for the transit agency pretended that documents discussing the deadly crash didn't exist. According to the Oregonian, the documents show that TriMet actually trains their drivers to make illegal turns when space after a stop is limited. This comes amid revelations of other TriMet questionable actions, including handing out covert raises to management while slashing service and withholding documents in union negotiations.
Portland area animal shelters were awarded a $1 million grant from a California foundation for their management of animal care. The money will go a long way towards helping six shelters throughout the state provide care and services to animals and their owners. KBOO's Don Merrill spoke with Debbie Ward, the manager of the Washington County Shelter.
It's a very great day for the pets of the Portland community. We have a coalition of shelters throughout the Portland metro area that includes Washington County, Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Clark County, Washington, that all work together as a coalition to save the lives of the animals in the shelters. And for the past 2 years, no healthy pet has been euthanized in any shelter in the Portland area.
That's wonderful.
Which is amazing news. It's great news. So that is being rewarded with a grant from an organization called Maddie's Fund, which is located in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they have given the shelters to divide $1 million. What we will be doing with that money is to not just rest on our laurels. So while we are saving every healthy animal, a lot of the animals that come into the shelters are unhealthy and need a lot of help. Many times these animals are coming in after years of neglect, so they may have anything from a shattered leg to, you know, severe medical problems, or they may have behavioral problems that were exacerbated over time because nobody worked with the animal. And so all of the shelters are using the funding that we're each individually getting to be developing a veterinary, or expanding our veterinary or our behavior programs to be able to do more for those animals that need more. So it's really taking things the next step forward in our community, which is very exciting.
I was reading about how the shelters are also going to pool some of their money for future projects. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's a very exciting thing that we each pledged that we would pool together 35% of the grant that we each received into a collective effort, which allows us to work on things strategically and also allows us to develop some new programs that would benefit all of us. So, for example, one of the ideas that we've talked about is potentially developing a kitten nursery. So there's a place for neonatal kittens to be getting round-the-clock care. So, you know, some of those ideas are things that we'll be developing over the next couple of years as we kind of identify what things would do the most good that would be best done in a collaborative area rather than have each shelter just have a tiny program, have everybody come together for something that it makes some sense to have a benefit of a collaborative effort.
If people want to find out more about the work the shelters are doing, where can they go?
Well, a great place to start is the website. The coalition is called ASAP, which is the Animal Shelter Alliance of Portland. So the website for ASAP is asapmetro.org. So that's asapmetro.org. And that has some good information. And then it also shows all of the participating organizations there and allows you then to click to each of the organizations that are involved with the effort.
Okay, Barbara, thank you very much. And let me have your name again.
Debbie Wood.
Debbie, sorry, I'm glad I asked. Okay, and you are the director?
Manager of Animal Services for Washington County, and we operate the Bonnie L. Hayes Small Animal Shelter.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Khalil Edwards from Racial Justice at Bro to talk about plans for Pride in June. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock welcomes Bobbito Garcia for his upcoming film, Doing It in the Park, and a Brooklyn, New York native and activist who will speak on his project called 10 Frisk Commandments. Tomorrow's weather forecast in Portland calls for 90% showers with a high of 53 degrees.
It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Stock market soars, exulted a typical headline in early May when the Dow Jones average topped 15,000. But this index of Wall Street wealth gives a false picture of our nation's true economic health. Yes, the privileged few are doing extremely well, But the workaday many are struggling and falling further and further behind as the jobs market sinks steadily from mere recession down into depression. The monthly unemployment reports don't tell the depths of misery out here in the real world beyond the view of Wall Street and Washington elites. For example, President Obama hailed the news that unemployment dipped to 7.5% in April. Unstated, though, was the stark reality that this good news dip was not due to a jump in job offerings, but to a bad news labor market so weak and discouraging that Americans are dropping out of it or never entering it. More than a third of our working-age population is no longer even in the job market, and only 58.6% of us are employed. Put the opposite way, 41% of the potential workforce is not working, about 102 million people. One more statistic, and it's a chiller. More than one out of five American families report that last year, not a single family member had a job. Our people are trapped in a jobs crisis that's sucking the economic vitality out of our nation, but our leaders even refuse to acknowledge it. In fact, corporate chieftains deliberately exacerbate the crisis by hoarding trillions of dollars that ought to be rushed into job-creating expansions. And politicians add to the casualties by gleefully firing hundreds of thousands of teachers, firefighters, and other valuable public employees. This is Jim Hightower saying, America's middle class is burning to the ground, while Washington fiddles with nonsense and Wall Street feathers its own nest. It's disgraceful.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Last night, we reported on the release of documents showing the links between the government crackdown on the Occupy Wall Street protests and corporate interests, including the very banks that the protesters were standing up against. Today, another document release has revealed more details on how federal law enforcement coordinated with local police departments to evict Occupy encampments in cities across the country, including right here in Portland. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Heather Benno, a lawyer with the Partnership for Civil Justice.
I wonder if you could just give an overview of what you found out.
Occupy Portland is a good example of just how many parties were involved in cracking down on the Occupy movement nationwide. Of course, the government wants to point to Portland in particular circumstances, but the documents show that the circumstances in Portland are very indicative of a general strategy that was going on throughout the country in terms of shutting down Occupy encampments. These most recent set of documents show discussions between the mayor's office, local police, Department of Homeland Security, and also the participation of business interests, which from the beginning wanted to shut down the Occupy encampment. And it certainly shows the heightened level of information collection and collaboration between the federal government, local government, and these business interests in getting Occupy Portland shut down.
At the time, I remember we reported on a conference call that the Portland police chief was involved in that involved other police precincts nationwide and possibly the Department of Homeland Security. Did you find out anything about that?
There were a number of conference calls organized by a number of different organizations, including police consulting groups receiving Department of Justice monies, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and the Major Police Chiefs Association, for example. There were essentially numerous conference calls going on throughout the months, fall months, leading up to the eviction of Occupy Portland and other Occupies around the country. What these documents show is that the players involved in some of those conference calls, namely local law enforcement, were also communicating with other federal law enforcement agencies, such as the Department of Homeland Security. In other batches of documents, we saw the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Here, there's essentially DHS police that are responsible for monitoring federal property, but also are monitoring general Occupy activity with incredible scrutiny, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we know that you know, despite the individual participation on the local law enforcement conference calls, that the information was being shared outside of those contexts with federal law enforcement. And there was a vast web of communication and collaboration existing between law enforcement agencies around the country.
So it sounds like somebody at a pretty high level was feeling kind of threatened by the Occupy movement.
Of course. And, for example, the FBI documents show as well intelligence officers gathering information and reporting on the fact that the movement is spreading more popularly, for example, in certain areas of Florida where there's high unemployment or high levels of foreclosure. So the law enforcement was keenly aware of the demands of the Occupy movement, and every activity that the Occupy movement was to take, and then the question just becomes, in whose interest was this information gathering? And what these documents show is that it was in the interest of either some policymaker and, you know, policymakers within the federal government and local law enforcement and the business community.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Heather Benno with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, whose group just received new documents on the Occupy movement showing more detail into how law enforcement coordinated with federal government in the shutdown of Occupy Portland and other Occupy encampments. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
On last night's news, we reported that a Portland woman was arrested in Washington, D.C. at the Department of Justice while protesting unjust foreclosure evictions. Debbie Austin was forcibly evicted from her home in Northeast Portland along with her family in January, despite having made all of her mortgage payments. Since that time, Austin says Fannie Mae and the bank have spent nearly $63,000 on armed guards to keep her home empty while she and her family struggle to survive. Austin was one of 17 people arrested yesterday protesting the Justice Department's lack of action against the big banks that continue to engage unlawful foreclosure evictions. Another 11 people were arrested this morning while they were sitting arm-in-arm blocking the door of the Justice Department. D.C. police used tasers on the nonviolent protesters during this morning's arrests. For an update on what's happened since yesterday, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with a representative of the Home Defenders League.
When did you arrive on scene in D.C.?
The last 48 hours have been pretty wild. Monday, we had about 500 folks show up at the Department of Justice. They had a perimeter staked out. They knew we were coming. It wasn't a secret. We sent a letter asking for a meeting with Eric Holder. Obviously, he turned us down. It's quite the shame. And we wanted to tell him that in March, he had said that the banks were too big to prosecute. We think that that is fundamentally wrong, and that if they are too big to prosecute, they need to be broken up. And so we had 500 homeowners, people that are directly impacted by the financial crisis, to the Department of Justice and let them tell their story. And the police didn't want us there. They had a perimeter staked out, and we sort of gradually, peacefully, nonviolently moved forward. And we really wanted to keep the Department of Justice inside until they did their job, until they had done justice for the homeowners.
I understand some people were arrested yesterday. Can you tell me if those people are still in police custody?
We knew that if we stayed in the space at the Department of Justice, there's a real good chance that people could be arrested. And people were willing to take that risk because they felt strongly enough that their houses were being illegally stolen from them, and that it was time that the Justice Department felt the need and the horrible crimes from homeowners. And so there were 17 people that ended up being arrested. They refused to bail out, so they didn't want to give money into the system that really is not helping right now. And so they went in and gave the IDs as bank members, or bank CEOs, I'm sorry, Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, John Stump. These are CEOs of some of the biggest, most reckless banks in this country. And so actually it's really exciting that currently right now, some of these homeowners are going into court. And so Jamie Dimon finally has his day in court right now to answer for the crimes that he's committed against the American people.
I'm getting reports of violent arrests and people being tasered.
Last night was relatively peaceful. However, today, there was folks that stayed overnight. The Justice Department just decided to leave last night. They were tired of dealing with us. They just figured if they looked away, that we would go home, and we didn't. And so in the morning, there's a handful of folks still there. About 30 people stayed the night, and 11 people refused to leave this morning. So they were arrested. And there was two women, one from Chicago and one from Atlanta that were locked arms, just sitting down. And instead of separating the women, they used the taser on them. It was really sort of hard to watch the sort of response from the police right there.
Tell me what's next. How many more days does the Home Defenders League plan to be on hand in D.C. and camped out at the Department of Justice?
You know, there's a press conference today. Allies came out to show support for the homeowners and for bringing justice to the bankers. Additionally, tomorrow there's more activities planned. I can't really speak to what they are, but it's going to be a continued effort to show the Justice Department that we're here and we're serious and that we want to see justice for homeowners.
Describe for me what a satisfactory response from the Department of Justice will be.
You know, Eric Holder has changed his rhetoric slightly in saying that there are no banks that are too big to prosecute. He's gone back on a statement, said that yesterday in a hearing on Capitol Hill. But it's more than rhetoric. Like, we really need to see action. We need to see prosecutions for crimes, and we need to see consumer-friendly laws that are advanced that really protect the interests of homeowners from just a carte blanche abuse by the banks. So those are the things that we really want to see. We want to see an end to dual tracking. That's where you can go through foreclosure and the process of getting a modification at the same time. Therefore, you're sort of in this horrible limbo where you don't know if you're going to get a modification or if you're going to get foreclosed. In a report that the Alliance for Just Society released just last week called the Wasted Wealth Report, where we highlight the amount of wealth lost in this country due to the foreclosure crisis. And in that report, we advocate for principal reduction. So principal reduction for folks that are underwater. One of our members from Seattle, Washington, she's 40% underwater. She's never going to be right side up on that loan.
That was a representative of the Home Defenders League speaking with KABU reporter Robin Ryan from a Justice Department protest in Washington, D.C. today.
In a congressional hearing today, the Apple Corporation faced accusations of using a complicated structure of subsidiaries in foreign countries to get out of paying billions in U.S. taxes. Apple's CEO told a congressional committee this morning that Apple pays every dollar of tax that it owes. He went on to claim that Apple is a victim of an outdated tax system that handicaps the ability of American companies to compete with foreign companies. Apple sells most of its products outside of the United States, including many places where taxes are lower. There has been no suggestion that Apple has broken any laws. They are accused of using legal loopholes to claim that U.S. sales were really made in foreign countries. For example, in 2011, 64% of Apple's global pre-tax income was recorded in Ireland, where only 4% of its employees and 1% of its customers were located.
Isn't it obvious that you are not bearing the same tax burden as if you were bearing in the United States, which then gives you some advantage over corporations and companies which are smaller, which are strictly located in the United States of America? I'm not saying that's wrongdoing, but I think you would agree that it gives you a significant advantage.
Again, sir, I have tremendous respect for you. I see this differently than you do, I believe. What I see is Apple's earning these profits outside the United States. By law and regulation, they're not taxable in the U.S. We've set up a holding company to collect these after-tax profits from our different foreign subsidiaries into AOI. It then invests as any treasury kind of arm would. And the interest investment or the interest profits off of that are paid in the U.S. as they're required to under existing U.S. Treasury regulations.
Can you understand there's a perception of unfair advantage here, Mr. Cook?
Sir, I see this as a very complex topic that I'm glad that we're having the discussion. But honestly speaking, I don't see it as being unfair.
Many U.S. multinationals take advantage of a tax law that allows profits earned abroad to be tax-free, as long as they are not brought into the United States or repatriated. Total U.S. corporate profits parked offshore rose 15% to $1.9 trillion last year, according to the research firm Audit Analytics. Democratic Senator Carl Levin has called for closing some of these loopholes in the tax code, but has been unsuccessful so far.
Today, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed a lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service over tax code requirements for Section 501c4 groups. CREW is a nonprofit dedicated to promoting government ethics and accountability. Current IRS regulations grant 501c4 tax-exempt status to nonpartisan civic groups that promote social welfare, but these are not allowed to campaign during elections. However, some groups claiming 501c4 status have interpreted the tax code to mean they can spend up to 49% of their annual expenditures on electoral activities. During the 2012 election cycle, Section 501c4 groups spent nearly $255 million on elections without paying taxes. Crew Executive Director Melanie Sloan told CommonDreams.org, quote, "As the ongoing IRS scandal shows, the 501c4 regulation is unmanageable. It clearly conflicts with the tax code, and IRS employees are simply at a loss as to how to apply it." Ms. Sloan noted the 501c4 scandal highlights problems in IRS regulation and said changing the code would prevent abuses in future elections.
A Democratic representative from Massachusetts has introduced a bill in Congress to force gun manufacturers to include what is known as personalization technology in all handguns. Representative John Tierney pointed to a number of cases where what he called smart gun technology could have prevented children from being harmed or killed in firearms accidents. He said he got the idea for the Personalized Handgun Safety Act of 2013 from the latest James Bond film, Skyfall. In it, Bond escapes death with his hand when his handgun, which is equipped with technology that recognizes his fingerprints, becomes inoperable when a bad guy picks it up. KBOO's Don Merrill has more on the story.
Smart gun technology in the latest James Bond movie Skyfall may not be that far off. House Bill 2005, also known as the Personalized Handgun Safety Act of 2013, would mandate that nearly all newly manufactured handguns would be personalized within 2 years. Penny Okamoto, the executive director of Ceasefire Oregon, says that although gun manufacturers are being required to adopt this technology, she's not sure of the real reason.
You might be asking a very cynical person that question. There are two ways to view this. One, we can say gun manufacturers have seen a niche market and they simply want to manufacture more guns so they can sell more guns. That's a cynical view of it. On the other hand, we can also say that lawmakers, and I would hope gun manufacturers, have seen the light and they are very interested in producing a product